Chapter 19. Time Trials. Mum has been gone for a couple of months. I've been traveling. France, Northern Italy, and Rome. There's something humbling about Rome. The evidence of centuries visible at every turn produces an effect similar to that created by contemplation of the Milky Way. It puts you in your place. Memento mori. Remember you must die. That's the message of Rome. Usually the reminders come simply from contemplation of the generations that built and rebuilt the city. Sometimes, the reminder is more direct. One evening, I came upon a fatal accident on a quiet Roman corner. A 17-year-old girl, out on a Saturday night, had stepped off a curb and been hit by a scooter. She lay doubled over on the pavement, her disheveled clothing revealing a lacy thong and perhaps a speculative plan for the evening. A bystander checked for a pulse and shouted, "Un dottore!" Minutes passed, and no ambulance came. Next day, there was a bouquet on the corner with the inscription, "Una morte ingiusta." A little south of Circus Maximus, death has carved out one of the city's most peaceful oases. It is marked by a pyramid. Not ancient by Egyptian standards, the pyramid does date back several decades before the birth of Jesus, a tomb for a prominent Roman named Caius Cestius. It backs into an enclosed yard split into two sections. This is the cemetery for non-Catholic foreigners, sometimes called the Protestant Cemetery, most famous as the place where poets Keats and Shelley are buried. The stone of young Keats is marked by one of history's most famous epitaphs. This grave contains all that was mortal of a young English poet, who, on his deathbed, in the bitterness of his heart, at the malicious power of his enemies, desired these words to be engraven on his tombstone. "Here lies one whose name was writ in water." February 24, 1821. It reads like a young man's epitaph, a howl at the unfairness of early death. That is somewhat deceptive. Keats requested only that last memorable line. The preamble was added by friends. It seems the greatest anguish was reserved for those left behind. Keats' friend Shelley was so impressed by the Protestant cemetery that he called it the most beautiful and solemn I have ever beheld. He would be buried there in 1822, in the newer, more crowded, most beautiful portion of the cemetery. There are tight rows of monuments, flowering trees, and stray cats, all well cared for. In the midst of noisy, chaotic Rome, the peace of this stone garden seems almost supernatural. It belies the passion and complexity lying behind a simple stone, the hidden tales that make every cemetery a cousin of Spoon River. My mother loved the Spoon River anthology, Edgar Lee Masters' collection of verses recounting life stories from a fictional town cemetery. And I know she would have loved this place, with all its implied mysteries. A Canadian flag marks the grave of diplomat E. Herbert Norman. Why would Norman's grave be found here? A man whose career played out in Japan and Egypt, and whose purported suicide in Cairo has been a source of speculation ever since, was for some reason buried in this hallowed piece of Roman ground. Nearby, the 1899 tomb of Virginia officer Thomas Jefferson Page is decorated with fresh banners bearing the Confederate stars and bars. Other stones imply tragedy. Children, teenagers, English youths who died while making the grand tour. Most were luckier, laid to rest in their beloved adopted city after long distinguished lives. Inscriptions on the older monuments are carefully worded. Prior to 1870, when Rome was ruled by the Vatican, it was forbidden to make any mention of God or salvation on these stones, lest anyone think that non-Catholics might be bound for heaven. Many begin with the carefully worded formula, "Sacred to the memory of." Beautiful as it is, this whole cemetery was intended to serve as a ghetto of the damned. A beautiful cemetery can be a reassuring place. Elegant monuments offer evidence that lives matter. People are remembered. But how many of the numberless dead are honored this way? These tombstones are the exception, not the rule. The real message of the beautiful Protestant cemetery seems to be, some lives matter. More pass away unmarked. In his book A Night to Remember, Walter Lord recalls that on April 14, 1912, the New York American sadly informed readers that tycoon John Jacob Astor was dead. He perished, the paper reported, in the sinking of the Titanic. Deep in the story, it was also noted that as many as 1,800 others may have been lost. 1,800 barques. My mother has no grave or memorial stone, nor would she have wanted one. Such grandiosity would have made her spin in that grave like a jet turbine. In the 21st century, a large resting place is hard to justify anyway. Our supply of land is finite. Some cemeteries are already recycling plots. Do you really want to replace your carbon footprint with a dirt one? Besides, a body buried in a closed casket does not really return to the soil, as the poets suggest. There's not enough oxygen, and the human body is too large and too watery to be consumed by the right sort of microorganisms. The body rots, but rich black loam does not result. Just a foul mess. So, a Swedish company called Promessa Organic has developed a method of human composting. After death, you'll be freeze-dried to remove body moisture, then broken up like a tray of ice cubes, and buried, close to the surface, in a biodegradable aerated box. You'll be nourishing local plant life within the year. As for cremation, it's not exactly environmentally friendly either. There's the cremation process itself, which requires tremendous heat. On average, a human cremation sends 550 pounds of carbon dioxide into the heavens. Even scarier is the vaporization of mercury fillings. According to a 2005 study cited on the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency website, cremation released 6,600 pounds of mercury into the atmosphere that year alone. Good old Mum was clearly planning ahead for a greener demise. Losing all her teeth at an early age removed the need for fillings, mercury or otherwise. And considering her weight, reducing Mum to ashes might have been accomplished with a bag of charcoal briquettes from Canadian Tire. Mum did not want to be trouble. Yet, if we ever completely eliminate the traditional graveside ritual, something archetypal will be lost. Hollywood would never stand for it. In a future without cemeteries and burial, how will they stage that crucial scene in which somber mourners gather, with one hiding a guilty secret behind dark glasses? You don't get that with cremation. There's an appealing quality to a gravestone, and more particularly, to an epitaph. Like the dream of a huge wedding celebration, it's an ideal that represents a moment of passage and transition, a statement about life's enduring meaning. It's hard to let go of that final spotlight opportunity, that grand question savored in moments of morbid narcissism. What do I want on my tombstone? What would we have put on Mum's? How would we have proclaimed our love? It's traditional for a gravestone to be inscribed with verse. When I think of what our mother accomplished, a famous poem does come to mind. It is This Be the Verse by English poet Philip Larkin, which starts like this. They fuck you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. He does cut the poor folks some slack a little later, adding, but they were fucked up in their turn. That depressing cycle does not hold true for everyone. Still, it is recognizable to millions. And my mother's experience might very well have fit right in. Victimized by her own mother, she was by Larkin's lights poised to pass it on to become a meddling, manipulative guilt machine. She didn't. She broke the chain. Philip Larkin can count himself lucky. He did not become a famous poet for his upbeat attitude. Larkin is reported to have said that for him, deprivation served the same poetic purpose that daffodils did for William Wordsworth. Given a happier view of parenting and life in general, what path would Larkin have taken? Greeting card verse? A career that saw him named Britain's greatest post-war writer in a 2008 Times survey may have been stillborn had Larkin been born a Burgess. As a description of family life, Larkin's This Be the Verse has become a modern classic. As an epitaph for Joan Burgess, though, it would be problematic. We'd have to add a postscript to make clear that our mother was the exception, a woman who defied Larkin's pattern. Something along the lines of, "I know you are, but what am I?" Too complicated for a headstone, really. Better to inscribe a simple statement of tribute. But what? "Here lies Joan Burgess, our beloved mother. Bet she was better than yours." Too competitive. "Here lies Joan Burgess. If you ever met her mother, you'd be leaving flowers here right now." I like it. She wouldn't. "Here lies Joan Burgess, one tough mother." No. "Here lies Joan Burgess. Her ordinary life became a medium for the extraordinary." The simple truth, whether or not she realized it. As it is, we have only that park bench inscribed, "Mum and Dad, it's been 50 years, so sit." That one she got to see. And modest though she was, she loved it. Every day I spend in Rome begins the same way. I leave the Hotel Orlando near Termini Station and head toward Piazza della Repubblica for my morning coffee. On the way, I pass along a quiet little street that empties into the square. Barely longer than its name, Via delle Terme di Diocleziano is shaded by orange trees. That shade is a precious thing in a hot Roman summer, and makes the little street a logical place for the used book, magazine, and movie stalls that line its north side. You can find items here not seen in the shops that crowd the Pantheon or Trevi Fountain. Everything from Italian-language Batman comics to pulp westerns to bits of fascist history not found in more reputable spots. I stop in front of a rack displaying a fascinating series of postcards, reproductions of Italian propaganda posters from the Second World War. A thuggish Jew in a Star of David coat, standing before the New York skyline, fist outstretched. A leering black soldier laden with plunder in a church where the crucified Christ leans over in the rubble. A brutish black GI draping his arm around the Venus de Milo, marked with a $2 price tag. Note to Italian propagandists, the French already plundered that one. The proprietor wanders over. Marco is a balding, stocky man with an expired cheroot clenched in his teeth. "You understand I must be careful about how I display these things," he says. "Some people misunderstand. But pictures like this tell you more about the time than an entire book. It's economy of energy." Marco comes from warrior stock. "I'm from San Giorgio del Sannio," he tells me, "where many Roman legions were defeated." "My ancestors come from Scotland," I reply. "We were known to scrap a bit ourselves." "Scotland!" Marco cries. He reaches onto a shelf and pulls out an old book. It is greenish-brown, wrapped in plastic, and sealed with bits of old tape, illustrated with a painting of a mountain lake. The cover reads, "Loch Lomond and the Trossachs," painted by E. W. Hasselhast, RBA, described by George Eyre Todd. Inside, a dedication in faded pen is dated August 1924, 2 years before my mother was born. Whether by luck or through an instinctive genius, Marco has struck a major chord. "There's a song about Loch Lomond," I tell Marco. "Do you know it?" His cheroot curls slightly northward in an expectant grin. "So? For the first time since those nights in the hospital room, when my lullaby was broken and unsettled by my mother's labored breathing, I sing Loch Lomond. It's one of the only songs I really know how to sing." By the time I finish, Marco's eyes have narrowed, taking on an aspect of shrewd appraisal worthy of Simon Cowell. "I can hear when a man sings a song a certain way," he says. He hands me the book. This is a gift. Turn left at Piazza della Repubblica, and there is Via Nazionale, sloping away to the southwest. In the morning sun, the winged chariots of Il Vittoriano Monument are framed against the horizon. Strolling downhill on one of those fine mornings, I find the street blocked off about halfway down. A little crowd stands behind barricades looking down the empty street. Giro d'Italia, a man in a Panama hat explains. Italy's biggest bike race is wrapping up. I've never seen a bike race in person before. I stand waiting for a surging pack of bikes and brightly clad riders to charge into view. Finally, a single rider appears. One bright little rainbow swinging around the bend and up the hill, followed by a support car. Minutes later, another rider and another car, and then another, each riding alone. The man in the Panama hat explains again, "Time trials today." Time trials. Each rider against the clock. Your starting place is irrelevant, nor do you win by crossing a set finish line ahead of the other riders. It's you against a stopwatch, traveling the distance as best you can. So far, my Italian sojourn has been wonderful. A highlight was the week spent with a tiny rented Alfa Romeo, exploring the hill towns that lie behind the Italian Riviera close to the French border. On a continuum of car rental situations with driving to a management seminar in Brownsville at one end, this would be at the other. Some towns you find on a map, but the best ones you find by mistake. Baiardo was a hidden hamlet at the end of a randomly chosen road. I wandered its stone ramparts, sat alone in a roofless chapel ruin, then idled at a small cafe atop the main street while the locals wandered from table to table visiting. Soon a woman appeared, escorting her elderly mother. The small, white-haired lady moved from group to group, greeting her friends while clinging to her daughter's arm. I buried my face deep into my day-old copy of the International Herald Tribune. It was embarrassing to sit there among strangers, crying. And yet, such moments have been fairly rare, disturbingly rare, it seems to me. My emotions are a mystery. There's no manual for personal grief, and I'm not sure what I expected. Nonetheless, there's something unsettling about my reaction to Mum's death. I seem to be taking it too well. Lynn was there at the moment of death and described her feelings to me later. "I felt nauseous," she said. "Seeing Mum going, and I couldn't do anything, it made me ill." I wonder at that. I sobbed when I saw Mum's body, but there was little in my subsequent reaction that could be described as anguish. Compared with Lynn and Les, my response has been matter of fact. There's an expectation that our grief will function as tribute. Our pain will be in proportion to our love. No one mattered to me more than my mother. Now that she is gone, I think about her every day. The trigger might be a little white-haired lady in Baiardo, but usually just a mundane recollection. Other times simply a reflexive reminder that she's gone. Yet I'm not shattered by her death. My life has continued. And now here I'm in Italy, scandalously enjoying myself. It makes me uncomfortable. It doesn't seem right. My friend Colleen, a TV news anchor from Vancouver, meets up with me in Rome. I'm joining her for dinner at a little spot called L'Orso Ottanta. The antipasti platters offer more than you can eat for a very reasonable price. It's a little like being adopted by someone's Italian grandmother for an evening. Colleen has warned me that this will be no ordinary dinner. John Caspar is a co-worker of Colleen's and his wife Sienna, a good friend. The couple has been on an Italian tour along with their two sons Grant and Rylan. They've been in Paris and Tuscany and visited Siena's almost namesake Italian town of Siena with one N. Rome is the last stop on their family vacation. Soon they'll be returning to Vancouver, where they will wait for John to die. The trip was originally scheduled as a romantic kid-free jaunt through Europe to coincide with a Paris conference that Siena, a gerontologist, was scheduled to attend. The plan changed the day John was diagnosed. It was stage 4 throat cancer, commonly called smokers and drinkers cancer. John neither smoked nor drank, but there's no appeals court. His case was terminal. "We sat the boys down," Sienna says, "and told them that they each got to pick a lifetime memory with John. Both boys are in French immersion in school, and Grant had earlier lamented the fact that neither John nor I spoke any French yet. So Grant's wish was to turn our Paris trip into a family affair. My wish for a lifetime memory with John was to go to Siena, Italy, a place I'd wanted to see. We decided to add Rome, Pisa, and San Gimignano." So far, everything has gone miraculously well. The family is taking full advantage of what grace the situation affords. Before the trip, there was a huge party in Vancouver with old friends and relatives flying in from all over to celebrate John's life and say their goodbyes. The family's European trip was planned as a final indulgence. It has been everything they hoped. John sits across from me at the long table. He's 49 with glasses, graying hair, and an arguable resemblance to actor Denholm Elliott. He's cheerful and animated. The only evidence of his illness is his skin, blotchy and peeling. But that might just as easily be the aftermath of a long day under the Tuscan sun. One other clue. John isn't eating. Instead, he takes occasional sips of water from a little bag that looks like a wineskin. Intensive radiation therapy to his neck and throat has damaged his salivary glands. His taste buds, too. There would be no point in his sampling the array of homey Italian dishes covering the length of the table. That joy has gone on ahead of him. For John, the pleasure of dinner is now the pleasure of company. Dinner is lively and fun, if understandably touched by a sense of the surreal. Here is a social situation to flummox the sagest advice columnist. How do you engage with a man you are meeting for the first time over dinner, knowing that any further or deeper connection will be rendered impossible by his imminent death? The answer is provided by the family's gracious example. It is only necessary to follow their lead. They are frank and open, talking as easily about their situation as they do about their lovely rented villa in the Tuscan countryside. At the big farewell party in Vancouver, John encountered an old acquaintance. "This was a guy I had wanted to reconnect with for years," John says, "but he had always put me off when I suggested we get together. Now here he was at the party, looking a little sheepish. He asked, 'Any chance of having that coffee now?' I told him, 'Tom, if I have a chance to meet up with you in November, I'd love to do that.'" As Tom and all of the other guests knew, doctors had told John he was unlikely to live past October. "Tom nodded," John recalls. "He understood what I was saying. I wasn't trying to be nasty. It's just that I had to prioritize. I had to make time for the people who were there for me." Too soon, we stand outside the restaurant on the cobblestones of Via Orsini. I've pretty much grasped that any social awkwardness on my part is not particularly important in this context. All the same, it is a genuine struggle to think of an appropriate farewell. "John," I finally say, "I hope you get to keep that November coffee date." We shake hands and part. John goes into a rapid decline not long after the family's return home. This time, the doctors had it right. He dies on October 9th, 2009. It will be 5 months before I meet Sienna again. On a drizzly December evening, she joins Colleen and I for dinner at a Vancouver Chinatown restaurant. Sienna is a strong woman, with a successful career and 2 young sons to raise. Keeping it together after her husband's death has been important to her. But as she carries on, dealing with her private grief, Sienna has found herself running up against popular notions of a widow's suitable response. "People expect you to go to pieces in an obvious way," she says. "If you don't visibly lose control of yourself, they think you're cold." Here, I realize, is the person to talk to about my own situation. I want to understand, why am I not devastated? A couple of years ago, I was a regular at a restaurant on Vancouver's Robson Street, the kind of casual food and drink place known in Japan as an izakaya. For years I'd been smitten with Kay, one of the managers there. One day, I decided to ask her out, against the advice of friends who warned me that, no matter how lengthy the acquaintance, the warmth of a professional waitress is only a required pose. I asked her to dinner. That look of ardent desire I had craved appeared in her eyes. It was directed at the floor, which she was clearly imploring to open up and swallow her whole. I had never seen a human being squirm with such exquisite discomfort. I went home to my apartment. Leaving the lights off, I lay down on the floor. I felt about as devastated as it is in my poor capacity to feel. Mortified, humiliated, crushed. Now I ask my dinner companions, why would I experience utter devastation at being rejected by a waitress and greet the death of my own mother with relative calm and acceptance? It's ego death, Sienna replies. Your ego was crushed when you asked that woman out. With your mother, your ego was not at stake. It sounds like there were no lingering issues between you, no conflicts unresolved or things unsaid. So the death of your mother didn't give you that same sort of pain. My mother had a husband and 5 children. Each of us experienced her differently. Each of us forged a relationship that was unique in each of our lives and different in turn from the others. My mother and I had a relationship that belonged only to us, with its own rules and dynamics. So would my grief differ from the pain of my siblings and that of my father. We may have started out in a pack, but ultimately, each of us would travel alone, looking back once in a while to confirm the reassuring presence of that support vehicle, out of the way but always keeping pace. Gone now. But tomorrow, time trials continue. Chapter 20. Goodbye, Christmastown. 1,305 miles from Vancouver to Brandon. A long drive, especially when your car is old enough to vote. BMW calls it the ultimate driving machine, but after 20 years, it's just another elderly Bavarian. Most will tell you that all the good parts of the journey are in the first half, the Okanagan Valley, the Cascade Range, and the magnificent Rockies. But the highlight of my drive usually comes late on day one, when night has fallen along the length of the Trans-Canada, and I finally burst free of the claustrophobic mountains into foothill country. I pull the reliable old Frau onto the shoulder, step out, and stare upward. My hometown is still a couple of provinces away, but already I experience a powerful sense of return, of home. Spread above me, across the clear prairie night, are the stars. All of them. No mountains to impose themselves, no city lights to whitewash the deep blue firmament. The Milky Way is frozen vapor, stretching almost to the southern horizon. We get a mere sampling in the big city. Next day's drive on that prairie highway is a long chase after a shimmering, evaporating pool. Most of the stately old grain elevators are gone, but the freight trains still roll between fields of yellow canola and golden wheat, and sometimes even a dry lake of blue flax. A little bit of country music, a lot of Lover Boy, and then hours at a time when the AM radio plays nothing but the thunderstorms that crackle on the horizon. I cross Alberta and Saskatchewan into Manitoba. There, just past the town of Verdun, I meet an eager young recruit of the RCMP who's determined to prove that Manitoba has the highest speeding fines in the country, regardless of whether a man might be hurrying home to visit his anxious and bereaved old dad. The final miles take me along Highway 1A, the old road that once led voyagers to the welcoming arms of the Starlight, now Casablanca, Motor Hotel. These days, the first significant structure on the western edge of town is my new destination, River Heights Terrace. Crossing that final flat stretch of farmland, I'm suddenly aware of the scene as it appears from Dad's third-floor balcony, the empty fields, the ribbon of road, and the BMW, not quite at the point where the whining tires will cross the sonic horizon. This is my first visit since Mum's death. Now I'm standing at the door of Dad's apartment. What I see leaves me stupefied. River Heights Terrace has grown on me. Like most relative youngsters, my attention was initially focused on the bingo and the gossip, but even before Mum died, my feelings had changed. Residents of this little 3-story community understand illness, difficulty, and grief. They know the drill. They help out. There's a woman named Lorna on staff, an indefatigable wonder whose paid work involves cleaning and serving. Her mother hen fussing over the River Heights brood comes at no extra charge. Some of the residents turned out for the funeral, and the expressions of sympathy and support were sincere. I'm glad Dad lives here. It's true that they boil a piece of broccoli until it loses structural integrity, and some of the framed prints along the hallways are a half step up from dogs playing poker. But no one's forcing you to play bingo or carpet bowl if you don't want to. Residents feel it's a pretty good place to be. Still, pain stalks these hallways. There's no exterminator they can call about that. As I stand before Dad's new one-bedroom apartment, I'm looking at that pain, spelled out. River Heights apartment doors come equipped with nameplates to identify the occupants. Our old nameplate read, Bill and Joan Burgess. Someone has taken a saw and sliced out the middle. Now Dad's door is marked by two broken fragments. Bill Burgess, it says, but with an abrupt break in the center. As it turns out, it wasn't the work of some grim hall monitor. Dad did it himself. Always the determined, if somewhat graceless, handyman. I thought I'd better change it, he says sheepishly. A lot of things have changed for Dad. His eyesight is just one of them. Watching hockey with him was bad enough when he couldn't remember what color of uniform to cheer for. Now, thanks to macular degeneration, he can barely see the uniforms. Can you really follow this? How do you see the puck? They need a bigger puck. Dad, I reply, you say the same thing during NBA games. They could play hockey with a basketball and it wouldn't matter. TV sports and sunsets are the main events on Dad's schedule these days. He's developed an evening tradition. When it's close to sunset, I pour myself a scotch and sit rocking by the window, he tells me. Mum's trophy is framed against the sky. If I rock back and forth a little, it even looks like her leg is kicking. Plans have been made. Once my mother's ashes are joined by her husband's, they will be spread together on a wooded lakefront path, not far from our beloved old cottage in Clear Lake. But it is another Fuller reunion that preoccupies Dad these days. In conversation, he often circles around to the same question. If we are pure spirit, he asks, how will I recognize her on the other side? Dad is a theologian whose habitual spiritual musings have suddenly been transformed into the most immediate of concerns. He has spent years reading the works of Marcus Borg and Bishop John Shelby Spong. Now he parses their words with the urgency of a contract lawyer. One day he calls, sounding down. He's been fretting about a recent Spong interview published in the United Church Observer. Spong is saying there's no point in kidding people about heaven, Dad says. He says it's a false comfort. I know what he's saying, but it's hard to hear that now. Dad and I have taken a lot of pleasure in our theological debates over the years. I've always taken the skeptic's view. Earthly institutions must not be held hostage to the dictates of ancient scriptures and superstitious beliefs, I proclaim, with index finger wagging aloft. For conservative clerics, the afterlife is both carrot and stick, the threat and reward that impels compliance. But the debates have lost their sport now. This is no longer an argument I want to win. Dad has enough doubts anyway. You can see, he tells me ruefully, how people construct their beliefs out of necessity. But the great thing about the afterlife is, it's an unresolvable argument. You can't Google the facts. I can at least Google Spong. I find the Observer interview online. It turns out to be a winning case for the defense. Look, Dad, Spong just says he doesn't want to tell bereaved people that their loved one is sitting on a cloud somewhere. But later, the interviewer asks, the average person in the pews wants to know this. When I die, is there anything more? Will I know my family, my friends, my loved ones? How do you answer that? And Spong replies, this entire book, Eternal Life and New Vision, is an attempt to say yes. The person I am is so deeply shaped by powerful, life-giving relationships. If I share in God's eternity, they have to be part of that. I can't get beyond that. So there you go, Dad. Spong believes you'll see Mom again. Just no clouds. Dad seems pleased to have the good bishop back in his corner. To his credit, he's not grasping at any old straw. When Jock buys him an audiobook of 90 Minutes in Heaven, the bestseller in which Don Piper describes his near-death experience as the fulfillment of his Christian faith, Dad is not impressed. "Sounds like a Baptist Sunday sermon," he grumbles. His children would like to deny him the reunion he craves. By summer 2009, however, it is looking imminent. Dad is back in hospital. The diagnosis this time, aortic dissection, a type of aneurysm that involves leakage between the walls of the aorta. It can lead to almost instantaneous death. 50% of cases never even reach the hospital. It's yet another terrifying addition to our growing medical lexicon. Many parents cherish the fond hope that their children will someday acquire a medical education. But not this way. We're like jailhouse lawyers, self-taught in the prison library. Lynn gets to Brandon first. "The ER doctor tells me Dad is resting okay," she says over the phone. Then he says to me, "He's quite a delightful guy." She gives an exasperated snort. "Like we don't know?" By the time I get to the hospital, Dad looks pretty good for a man with the sword of Damocles dangling over his head. He's anxious to get out, but there are still concerns. His medical file mentions a problem with dementia. Dad strikes me as impatient, but not particularly demented. I ask a nurse what it's about. "It's in his file," she says. "He's been diagnosed with Alzheimer's." "But what has he been doing lately?" "Well," she says, "when staff have been trying to get him out of bed to take some exercise, he keeps asking for his walker."
"His walker?"
"Yes." "It helps him walk?" "That doesn't seem irrational," I say. "We want to be careful," the nurse tells me. "He's been diagnosed with dementia." A perfect circle. The Alzheimer's diagnosis suggests that his actions will be suspect, and his actions are found to be suspect because of the diagnosis. Like they always told us in school, once you get a reputation, it's hard to shake. Happily, the consensus is now that Dad is in so much trouble that it doesn't matter where he is. So we're going home. There's an exit interview with Doc Molecule. "Live your life," he tells Dad. "You could go anytime. If you have a rupture, we'd have to take you into Winnipeg and we'd never get you there in time. So just enjoy yourself." Not bad advice. All the same, hearing a message of doom from Doc Molecule seems oddly comforting. "Either way, it's okay," Dad tells me. "If things go wrong, I will see her again." There's not much point arguing with Molecule about the Alzheimer's issue, but I do anyway. It's how we roll. His confident diagnosis is in itself evidence of hubris. Diagnosis of Alzheimer's always involves guesswork, and autopsies regularly prove that supposed cases were misidentified. Vascular dementia, caused by just the sort of heart problems Dad has experienced, is responsible for many of the same short-term memory problems often ascribed to Alzheimer's. A 2010 British study showed GPs commonly mistake one condition for the other. Studies of a new spinal fluid analysis procedure hold promise, but as of now, diagnosing Alzheimer's is still a crapshoot. And crap is just what we expect from this quarter. Yet, a growing body of anecdotal dad-related evidence suggests that it may be necessary to take a very painful step. I may be forced to agree with his doctor. Dad's memory holds information like a monkey holds playing cards. "I enjoy reading about the baseball games in the paper the next day," he tells me one night while we're watching baseball, "because I've forgotten what happened." We're all engaged in a game of trying to gauge Dad's true abilities. It's difficult. His familiar short-term forgetfulness occasionally shades into something more troubling. One day, while we're looking through scrapbooks together, he asks me, "When was Steve born?" The vultures are circling. A vigilant bank employee cancels Dad's credit card after telephone solicitors peddling miracle Chinese tea succeed in getting his security code from him. These visits are gradually evolving from the old routine of eating and chatting and enjoying each other's company to something more like babysitting. On a visit to Clear Lake one day, Dad and I stop in at Poor Michael's Bookshop and Cafe, owned by our friends Murray and Lee. Dad heads for the men's room while I stick my nose in the paper. A few minutes later, I look up to see Murray leading Dad back through the front door. He'd gotten lost on the way back from the bathroom and gone looking for me outside.
With Dad, there's no telling what random bytes of the data stream will stick and which will slide on past. It's an odd dynamic. The conversations we have are roughly the same, the interactions apparently normal. 2 minutes later, it may well be gone. Repeat the information, and it seems for all the world he's hearing it for the first time. And yet you cannot simply assume that Dad's brain is a bottomless bucket. He remembers a significant amount. There's just no telling what. So you simply keep talking, having ordinary conversations, all the while remembering to take nothing for granted. It involves overcoming reflexes built up over a lifetime, unlearning the assumption that a question answered will stay answered for more than 60 seconds, or that simple instructions will produce meaningful results 10 minutes later. Chronically forgetting the stories he told yesterday, Dad tells them again as if they had just occurred to him. And since the stories are almost always the same, his obsessions are clear. "Did I tell you about the times Mum came to rescue me?" he asks. "Once when I was in Winnipeg, taking a medical study program. Once when we were in Belgium on our European trip, we were going down to dinner, and Joan was wearing her favorite dress, a long blue and white one. It looked so beautiful. We were walking along the wide hallway that led down to the dining room, and there was an older lady coming along. She stopped us. She was a complete stranger, and she said to Mum, 'I just have to tell you how beautiful you look.' A complete stranger." Dad will tell me that story almost every day if I don't stop him. I stop him about half the time. Failing eyes and failing memory are a truly cruel combination. Dad doesn't deserve to star in the horrible little comedies that now play regularly at his apartment. Bad memory? He must write things down in order to remember them. Bad eyes? He can't read what he just wrote. It leads to moments like this. Dad is scanning his daytimer. It is August 19th. A July 24th appointment was written down in felt pen. The black marker leaked through the page, making meaningless black splotches on the calendar square for August 7th. "What's this here?" Dad asks. "It's nothing, Dad. Just felt pen that bled through the paper." "Are you sure? What's the date? Is it still July?" "No, Dad, it's August now. Today's August 19th.
August! It can't be August! What's this written down here?"
"Just ink, Dad. Just blotches."
"Are you sure? What does it say?"
Etc. Had I recorded my last attempt to read an address to him over the phone, the transcript could make you weep. Leaving phone messages or sending emails has become pointless. He can't see the keyboards, remember the passwords, work the devices. Fancy new computer sits on his desk like a dead stump in a wheat field. Once he complained to the River Heights management that his TV wasn't working. The manager came up to have a look and discovered that Dad was trying to change channels with the cordless telephone. Discipline is another major issue, but the problem here is not really medical. Dad used to possess an iron will. It was his wife. Now he'll eat ice cream 3 times a day if it's offered, and as a result, resembles a shoplifter attempting to steal a watermelon. He gives himself permission for a few too many scotches when twilight comes. If it hasn't come by 3 p.m., he might take an advance. There's some family concern being expressed about his liquor intake. But on the bright side, when he drinks, he stops eating. Memory gone, eyes fogged, and yet he is still essentially himself. As Donna Hamm puts it, he presents well. Even if it's true that the brain is being hollowed out, the facade seems unchanged. Upbeat, gregarious, loving, lovable. Dad's final days, months, or years will not resemble Mum's in that way, at least. We lost her by degrees. With Dad, the loss will be sudden and unbearably sharp. Morbid thoughts are unavoidable now. What to say about him when the time comes to speak? The tradition of eulogy suddenly seems unfair. Anybody who can afford a funeral gets one. Nice things are said of the deserving and the undeserving alike. I appreciate the obituaries run by British papers when a prominent figure dies. Not cruel, but not flinching from the facts either. Some obituaries are easily written. Tsutomu Yamaguchi, who died in January 2010, was the only person officially recognized as having survived the atomic blasts at both Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In the face of that awe-inspiring combination of bad and good fortune, the death notice writes itself. Other obits are trickier. Michael Jackson, pop wonderkind, vessel for breathtaking gifts, physical and creative. Mask-wearing, baby-dangling eccentric, accused child molester. There's the challenge of the eulogist at its starkest. And we are each of us Michael Jackson, if not to the same extreme. For the unremarked, and generally unremarkable, the job of the eulogist is difficult. And thus, out come the cliches. He lived, did his best, left grieving family and friends. True or not, it will be said. What can I add about my father? How to underline his goodness? Will it be necessary to resort to slander, insulting other recent dead for the sake of contrast? Bad form, I suppose. But Bill Burgess is deserving. My father is simple in the best sense of the word. Honest, open, straightforward, uncomplicated, good. He's earned his tributes. I once believed I was almost nothing like my father. It seemed to me I was my mother's son. I understood her emotional reactions, felt we were made of the same stuff. If there is one educational thread to my adult life, it has been the process of discovering how much I am also like my dad, and how lucky that makes me. Some vestige of his buoyant optimism has lifted me. My interface with the world resembles his. His essential decency may be available to me more by example than by heredity. Regardless, I'm proud and grateful to be my father's son. When the time comes, that's what I can say. For now, Dad's aorta is a valiant little vessel. He is resolutely refusing to drop dead, and so we have a decision to make. Christmas is coming. The prospect of a Yuletide holiday at River Heights, just the two of us, a tree, and a painful void, does not seem quite the thing. Instead, we'll go east. Lynn and family are in Toronto, Jock and another happy quorum of grandchildren close by in Mississauga. It only makes sense. We'll fly in separately, and Lynn will find places for us somewhere. So, it's goodbye Christmastown. Not the last change coming, nor the worst. Just another unfamiliar station on the road. When you're a kid, you pray for Christmas to hurry up and arrive. But the damn things keep coming, like the marching broomsticks of the Sorcerer's Apprentice. Finally, the only thing you want from Santa Claus is a break. That's the truth behind Dickens' Christmas tale. The terrifying spirit of Christmas yet to come leads Scrooge to his final resting place, and the old man falls to his knees in fear. Scrooge begs for the chance to change the future, and his wish is granted. But the spirit's reminder still stands. Ultimately, all our futures converge. Like Scrooge, we can only seize the day, and the next, as long as they're still on offer. That sentiment may never end up on a festive card coming from a wisecracking reindeer. But if you need a reason to have yourself a merry little Christmas, it's the best one I can think of. Beyond that, who knows? I can't convince myself of a heaven. I don't want to wrap myself in comforting myths. We're all best served by looking at matters clearly, constantly vigilant of the encroachment of wishful thinking. But, for the purposes of discussion, I am only too happy to leave the question open. It's only necessary for me to acknowledge my humble place in the universe and to admit there are things I cannot know. And that clears the way for harmless, even joyful speculation. There have been so many attempts over the years to illustrate a heaven, to imagine some scenario more satisfying than an enervating sea of white clouds and white wings and free jukeboxes offering nothing but harp solos. One of my favorite versions came from a 1998 Japanese movie, Afterlife. In that particular vision of eternity, heaven is reduced to a moment. The deceased begin their afterlives with a short stay at a sort of post-mortem way station, where the staff helps each newly dead soul select a favorite memory, a single moment of pure happiness. Then, that experience is recreated in a studio complete with the appropriate props and effects. As each subject relives his or her chosen memory, he or she disappears into it, forever to exist inside that moment, looping over and over again, always fresh, in a perfect, eternal now. I don't know what moment Dad would choose. Maybe I'm too squeamish to ask. But I know that something like this is happening to him already. As his short-term memory fails him, those old favorite loops replay in his mind, fondly repeated in every phone call. So perhaps I can guess my father's moment of heaven. It is in Belgium. It has been a lovely trip. He and Joan are leaving their hotel room and heading down the wide, luxurious corridor to dinner. She has put on her best dress, a long blue and white one. As they approach the majestic staircase, an older lady is passing, a complete stranger, but she stops. "I just have to tell you," she says to Joan, "you look so lovely." Joan blushes. Bill looks at his wife with joy and delight. After all, hasn't he been telling her that for years? His admiration is almost triumphant. The whole world can see it, and more than that, they understand. Elegant and graceful, with a self-possession that seems the outward expression of a wise and elevated soul. Here is Joan Burgess. This is the woman he loves. The end. 2012 postscript to follow.